There's no law pertaining to male fornication, unless one considers being forced to provide for one's own child a punishment. Had the tavern been empty, North would have gotten directly to the point. But since he has a large audience, he drags out the proceedings. I indulge his showmanship, knowing the assumption every other person in this room has already made. Another illegitimate birth. Another declaration of paternity. A bit of juicy gossip for the neighborhood to gnaw on for a few days. I dip my head in feigned respect. I come before the Court of General Sessions to deliver testimony regarding a death, as is my duty before the law and the state of Massachusetts. Well-rehearsed words. I need to be careful. A wave of mutterings rises behind me.
What death?
North asks, his eyes tightening at the corners. Joshua Burgess. Now the wave crashes ashore in a full-blown cacophony. North bangs his gavel on the table to regain order. When the room is silent once more, I continue. Joshua Burgess was found yesterday morning, caught in the ice off Bumberhook Point. I was called to this establishment to examine the body and render my opinion on cause of death. Ephraim shifts uneasily in my peripheral vision when he hears the cool note in North's voice.
And what is your opinion, Mistress Ballard, on cause of death?
North asks.
Murder.
Gasps, mutters, exclamations. These sounds erupt behind me, along with stools clattering backward, men springing to their feet. Several tankards tip over, and I hear the steady drip of ale splashing on the flagstone floor. Deaths are far too common in these parts, but murder is rare. I remain standing, expression as still and disinterested as I can manage. I keep my eyes on North, and he holds the gaze, locks it in place with his own. Beside him, Henry Sewell glances between us, his quill hovering above the record book he keeps for the court. It takes several seconds of gavel banging before order is restored.
That is a weighty charge, Mistress Ballard.
I charge nothing. I only state my findings. I stand straight and tall and speak with confidence. Bruises covered his face, torso, and groin. Several teeth were broken. It was clear he had been beaten badly while still alive. He had numerous broken bones. His neck was snapped, windpipe exposed, and rope burns were evident in a complete circle beneath his chin. It was obvious that, after being beaten, Joshua Burgess was hanged. I do not believe he was alive when thrown into the river. North stares at me, his dark eyes turned to flint, but I can't interpret the expression on his face. His voice sounds impartial when he asks,
How can you be sure that he was thrown in?
Oh, you bastard. You have never questioned my testimony before, I think. Then carefully say, It is a deduction based on the evidence.
And have you ever seen a man hanged, Mistress Ballard?
Yes. This astonishes me, coming from him, and I'm not afraid to show it. He of all people should know the answer to that question.
I have.
I ignore the disruption behind me, pay no attention to the standing, whispering, muttering crowd at my back. So intent am I on North, eager to identify the fleeting expression that crosses his face, that I don't notice the man who has come to stand beside me until he speaks.
Your Honor, he says, if I may address the court, I too have information pertinent to the situation.
Dr. Page. Damn it. Damn it all to hell. When Judge North speaks again, I finally recognize the look I hadn't been able to identify. Certainty.
Of course. Please state your name and profession for the court records. Dr. Benjamin Page, licensed physician and Harvard Medical School graduate.
The crowd gathered at Pollard's Tavern is adequately impressed. They murmur and nod their approval, lean forward, assess the man with curiosity. Several of the younger women sit up straighter, watch him with acute interest. They are looking for a wedding ring, any sign that he has spoken for. Despite my irritation, I can't deny that this is an excellent way for a new physician to advertise his services.
"Carry on, Dr. Page,"
North says, his voice louder, imperious.
"The court always respects the word of a trained medical professional. I, too, inspected the body of Joshua Burgess yesterday, but I'm afraid my findings are quite different from those of Mistress Ballard."
North lifts a hand, palm up, and waves it, giving him the floor.
"Please explain."
I curl my fingers inward, stopping just short of making a fist, as I turn my steady gaze to Dr. Page. He steps into the open area before the table, but speaks only to North.
"While it is true that the body in question does show some injury, I believe this is due to being swept downstream amidst ice and debris. A great deal of damage can happen to a body in churning water. In addition, there was no rope on or near the body of Mr. Burgess that would indicate a hanging. It is my professional opinion that he died from drowning, most likely due to intoxication, and that all injuries were incurred in a post-mortem state."
Page folds his hands across his stomach, as though he has just delivered a lecture on human anatomy, complete with appropriate Latin terminology, to a rapt classroom. Post-mortem. It doesn't take a linguist to decipher the definition of that word, but Page knows that it makes him sound knowledgeable and qualified before the court. After a moment, North clears his throat.
"Mistress Ballard?"
"Yes."
"When you inspected the body, did you find a rope on or near his person?"
"I did not."
"And the men who found him, did they see a rope?"
"No."
"You inquired about this?"
"I did."
"Because you found it curious as well."
"It was something I noted given the rope burns on his neck." I slide my eyes to the left and see the faint flicker of a crooked smile warp the corner of Dr. Page's mouth. I do not consider myself a scribe of any repute. I am a chronicler of facts, not feelings. However, the knowing look that passes between North and Page inspires a sort of enraged doggerel that Shakespeare himself might salute with his quill. "Thou crusty, open-arsed, babbling liar. Thou craven, hag-born maltworm. Thou dankish, prick-faced, leprous carrion." North steeples his fingers beneath his chin, considers.
"Rope burns without a rope? Is it possible you misinterpreted what you saw, Mistress Ballard?"
"It's possible the rope came off in the water, or was cut away, or reclaimed."
"I see."
North smirks, then scribbles something onto a sheet of paper and hands it to Henry Sewell. Clearly, Page had been sent to Pollard's not only to contradict my assessment, but to follow behind and interrogate the witnesses on all that transpired before his arrival. I curse myself for having left so quickly yesterday. I should have stayed with the body until he left. The tavern is silent now, all eyes on the three of us in our battle of wills. I stare at the doctor. Page looks only to North. But when North speaks again, his words and gaze are directed at me.
"I thank you both for coming today and for taking such care to examine the late Mr. Burgess. May he rest in peace. But after hearing the evidence, it is the court's decision that the death of Joshua Burgess was an accidental drowning, as stated by Dr. Page. This matter is settled. Mr. Sewell, please record these findings in the official record."
He looks to the crowd.
"Who is next?"
I do not stay to hear some ridiculous complaint one neighbor might have against another for taking the Lord's name in vain. Truth be told, I am more than a little tempted to do so myself. So I turn on my heel and walk away. I have half a mind to request that Amos Pollard drag Joshua Burgess into the tavern so the entire town can see for themselves. There is no possible way the river did that damage to his body. But I am halfway to the door, Ephraim moving to intercept me, when an idea flashes bright through my mind. Wait! I stop, turn, take one step back toward north. I can hear Ephraim curse under his breath directly behind me. My decision is final, Mistress Ballard. North's composure is broken now, his voice louder than necessary. I understand that, and I am not challenging your decision. I simply ask that Mr. Sewell record in the official court documents that there are contradicting views as to the cause of Mr. Burgess's death. One that states accidental drowning, I pause for effect, and one that states murder. I don't think it is my right before the law and the state of Massachusetts to request this. I give him the smile held in reserve for my enemies. As a trained medical professional, I am correct on this point. North knows it, and so do any number of other people in the room. As a midwife, I am granted a unique legal status most women do not enjoy. If he publicly refuses me, I will have cause to appeal to a higher court. And, should things grow contentious, North could be stripped of his appointment as judge for failing to uphold established law. He does not capitulate immediately, however, but rather twists his mouth in calculation for several seconds. Seeing no way out of it, he finally says,
"Very well, Mr. Sewell. Please note that my verdict lies with Dr. Page's assessment, but that there is, as Mistress Ballard has noted, a contradicting opinion."
Henry Sewell bends his head over the ledger, and I turn to leave once more. Ephraim now stands at the door waiting, my riding cloak over his arm, and an expression of urgency spread across his face. I hear Judge North call William Pierce forward.
"What is your complaint, Mr. Pierce?"
"I am here with my daughter, Sally, Your Honor, and she has two charges to make."
Again, I slow, stop, turn. Again, Ephraim curses, but audibly this time.
"Miss Pierce, what is your charge?"
North asks. Sally's voice is shaky, and she has to clear her throat to get the words out.
"I bring charges of fornication, Your Honor."
Now Ephraim is at my side, fist clenching the back of my dress, whispering,
"Don't,"
in my ear. "No, no, no, please, no," I think. I rise onto my tiptoes to get a glimpse of Sally over the crowd. The girl is staring at the ground, face crimson, lips pinched together in shame. William Pierce stands beside his daughter, one hand on her back, and I can see his fingers squeezing the small muscle in the dip between shoulder and neck.
"Against whom do you bring these charges?"
"Against my employer, Mrs. Rebecca Foster.
I have been delivering testimony in this room on the last Friday of each month for a decade, but never, in all of that time, have there been two such scandalous occurrences, and certainly not on the same day. The people of Hollowell will be chewing on this bone for years." William Pierce steps in front of his daughter.
"I told Sally to give her notice this morning, Your Honor, because it has come to my attention that Mrs. Foster is pregnant by a man not her husband. Sally heard her admit to this yesterday, and I feel that to remain in the Foster's employ would be a blight upon my daughter's character."
"That doe-eyed little traitor," I hiss, and Ephraim has to loop his arm around my waist to stop me from lunging forward.
"Rebecca isn't even here to defend herself."
"We need to go,"
Ephraim says, the tone of his voice brooking no argument. "Right now."
"Mr. Sewell, will you please note in the court records that Mrs. Rebecca Foster, wife of Reverend
Isaac Foster, has been formally charged with a gross and immoral sin of fornication.
While Henry Sewell records this charge, North leans forward and rests his elbows on the table.
What is your second charge, Miss Pierce?
She is terrified. That much is obvious.
Murder.
There is no outburst this time. Only the sound of Sally's feet shuffling across the flagstone floor as her father pushes her closer to the table.
In addition to saying that she was pregnant, I also heard Mistress Foster say that her husband did kill Joshua Burgess.
Now there are gasps of astonishment, whispers. Dr. Page takes a step back, glowers at her. I can see him try to figure out a way to explain his miscalculation.
No!
I am astonished at the sound of my voice, as is everyone else in the tavern, for the room falls suddenly quiet and all heads swivel to look at me.
That is not at all what Rebecca said.
Mistress. Ballard, North growls.
The reason Sally heard our conversation is because she was listening at the door while I was there yesterday. Did you hear me? I was there. Go on, ask her.
No one does. And both she and her father remain silent, though her eyes fill with frightened tears. It is clear Sally did not want to do this, but it is already done, and I feel no mercy for her.
North leans forward.
Mistress Ballard, I will not tolerate such an outburst in my courtroom.
I ignore him. What Rebecca said is that she hoped Isaac had killed the man. And can any of you blame her?
I look around the tavern, then take a step forward and glare at North. Can you blame her?
Enraged now, he brings his gavel down with a hard whack.
This is an obscene disruption.
No, it is an obscene miscarriage of justice.
Whack. Rebecca is not here to defend herself against these charges. Whack.
This foolish little ninny came in on the last half of a sentence and thinks she heard a confession?
No.
She's nothing more than an eavesdropper.
Whack.
You should not be presiding over this matter, I tell North. You are one of the men accused of raping Rebecca Foster. Whack, whack.
Henry Sewell sits beside the judge, pen held in midair, mouth open in astonishment.
And you?
I turn and point my finger directly in Sally's face.
You should be ashamed of yourself, you gossiping little liar. Do you have any idea the harm you've just done?
Whack, whack, whack.
I feel Ephraim's hand on the small of my back. There is a tug, urging me to leave. But no, I am too angry, too full of spitting fury to acknowledge him.
Mistress Ballard!
North's voice is filled with thunder now, and it is the only thing that breaks through the roar in my mind.
You are in contempt of court. Mr. Ballard, remove your wife from my presence immediately.
The air outside the tavern is clean and cold, without the slightest tinge of wood smoke. I can almost taste the frost on my tongue, the bite of winter settling into my lungs.
What were you thinking?
Ephraim hisses in my ear as he pulls me down the steps and toward the stables. I don't bother keeping my voice down.
I couldn't let her stand there and lie about Rebecca.
Hush!
Ephraim warns as a crowd of people spill out of the tavern. Their heads are bent low, whispering. Several of them look toward us, then away.
And that helped? What you just did?
I spoke the truth. And got kicked out of court. Everything else you accomplished today could well be dismissed.
He wouldn't dare.
Ephraim leads me through the stable door and toward the stalls where Sterling and Brutus wait for us. He pulls a shilling from his pocket and hands it to young Matthew Pollard, the stable boy. Like Moses, he looks like their father, though at the moment he is only dark and lanky. The big and brooding will take some years yet.
You just gave him the advantage, Martha. North could do anything now.
I'm not a woman given easily to tears. They're useless things that serve only to make your voice waver and your cheeks wet. But they accost me now, and I pushed them away with the back of my hand.
I couldn't stand there and do nothing. I couldn't. I won't.
When Matthew Pollard leads the horses away to saddle them, Ephraim sighs. He drops his forehead to mine.
You are too involved in this.
I never asked to be.
And I would never ask you to turn away from a friend, but that was reckless, Martha. That was dangerous. You called North a rapist in his own courtroom.
I said nothing that isn't already on the record, that isn't being whispered about in this town.
Behind closed doors, yes. But you said it to his face.
And you think it's better to whisper behind a man's back?
I think it's better to be prudent in your speech, measured.
Suddenly you're afraid to look a man in the eye and call him what he is? My husband flinches, looks away.
That was a long time ago.
It was no time at all. Yesterday. Just a moment. It is only ever a breath away from me. And I saw the truth of that when North asked if I'd ever seen a man hanged. He knows I have. He was there when it happened. And so were you.
35 years ago. Oxford, Massachusetts. December 19, 1754. Billy Crane jerked at the end of his rope. He'd pissed himself, most likely when the trap door fell, and a dark stain ran the length of his right leg. The drop was supposed to break his neck, but he was a tall man, and I could see that the rope hadn't fully done its job. His back was arched, and one foot twitched. I looked away, but Ephraim's hand lay soft against my cheek, gently forcing my gaze back to the gallows.
No, he said. Watch it to the end.
I tried to shake loose, but he leaned closer, insistent, mouth brushing my ear.
This is justice, Martha. You need to see it done.
No one needs to see this, I thought. But Ephraim held me still. The crowd gathered in the clearing below was silent, collectively holding its breath until the spasms stopped. I saw my parents before the tree, staring up at the twisting form of Crane, murder in their eyes. Only when the hangman cut the rope and let Crane's body drop to the ground with a heavy thud did Ephraim turn me into the wide shelter of his chest. And then I was crying, my voice muffled by the sharp December wind and the heavy linen of his shirt. I pummeled him with my fists until they ached, but Ephraim did not defend himself, or hold me, or say a word of comfort. We stood on a rise above the clearing, hidden beneath a copse of fir trees, the crowd below oblivious to our presence. So intent were they on the scene before them, there hadn't been a public hanging in those parts for almost 10 years, and my father had forbid me to attend this one. Private hangings, the ones motivated by revenge, were far more common, however. Grisly, barbaric. Father used several other words to describe the process, none of them fit for a woman's ears. But, I thought, he had forgotten to include riveting. He would lock me away for a year if he knew I'd seen them hang Billy Crane. Father had forced me to lay a hand on the family Bible and swear that I would not set foot out the door until Billy had been put in the ground to rot. And I would have obeyed if it weren't for Ephraim Ballard. He came to fetch me after my parents left, and I could no more refuse him than cease breathing. Finally, after I exhausted myself, Ephraim pushed my tears away with his thumbs and cupped my face in his hands. He looked at me as though I might shatter. He looked at me as though he was willing to pick up each and every piece if I did, as though he would put them back together with his own bleeding fingers. Ephraim offered one curt nod.
It's done then. He's dead.
Good God, Ephraim. Is this how you court a girl?
I took a deep breath and it rattled through my lungs, frantic, erratic.
Sneaking off in the middle of the day to see a man hanged?
The courting is done,
Ephraim said, and it took a bit of effort to suppress his smile.
All that's left now is the marrying.
I wanted to answer that hidden smile with one of my own, but couldn't seem to find one.
Besides, he added, it didn't take much convincing.
He tensed when I said, Father told me you testified. Ephraim was taller, but only by a couple of inches, and his wide blue eyes looked over the top of my head to rest on the scene below. He shrugged, his voice purposefully devoid of emotion.
I told them what I saw.
Them. 5 men. Just a handful of town elders, my father included, who'd met the night before to see what could be done about a man such as Billy Crane. I shuddered. They hadn't let me in the meeting at all. The clearing had emptied, and I searched it in a panic for my parents. I couldn't see them. We have to get back, or they will know you brought me. Ephraim seemed unconcerned.
Not yet, he said. They can wait.
I was about to protest when he nodded toward the base of the hill. A dark-clad figure began climbing toward us. He took the hill in a series of long, purposeful strides, and the moment I recognized him, I tensed. What is he doing here? Ephraim didn't answer. Instead, he stepped between us, so that I was partially hidden in the shadows beneath the tree. He grabbed the man's hand.
Joseph, thank you for coming. Of course.
Joseph North was young and handsome, and the humble words did nothing to hide the flush of excitement that rose above his collar. He'd given the deciding vote that had sealed Crane's fate.
Do you still need me this evening? Yes.
Ephraim peered at the sun, judged its angle in the sky.
4 o'clock. Make sure you bring the documents. I want it official. You caught me just in time, then. I leave first thing in the morning to join my regiment. We ride for Fort Beauséjour. Our orders are to force the natives out of Acadia.
He gave Ephraim a last thoughtful glance, then tipped his hat to me.
Martha?
Joseph North turned and marched back down the hill. When he was out of earshot, I stepped away from Ephraim, suspicion pinching the corners of my eyes. What was that about?
I've asked Joseph to be at your parents' when I take you home.
My father will be furious, but I hardly think legal protection is in order to marry us. I blinked. What? Ephraim took one hand with great care, as though lifting a robin's egg from a nest.
It's been only 2 weeks since.
He wasn't typically one to shy away from comment, but he couldn't seem to find the words for this. He cleared his throat, blushed, ran a finger along the base of my thumb. I know how long it's been. I tried to yank my hand away, but he clamped it into his own.
Your cycle,
Ephraim finally stammered.
It hasn't come yet, has it?
You can't know that.
Am I wrong?
My silence was answer enough.
Have you considered what will happen if you're with child?
I heard the strike before I felt the sting in my palm, but it was the pain that brought me to my senses. How dare you? He wasn't hurt so much as startled, but he grabbed both of my wrists and pulled them to his chest to prevent me from doing it again. He shook me just a bit, and I felt my teeth rattle.
What was that for? He demanded.
I won't have you marry me out of pity.
You don't think I want you anymore?
How could you? There, it was the truth, the unspoken tension between us. Ephraim's entire body trembled with rage. I was afraid he would shake me again, or kiss me. I couldn't tell which to expect by the look on his face. He did neither, in fact, but rather lowered his face until it was an inch from mine.
Let me be clear, he growled, furious. My feelings haven't changed, but I need to know if yours have.
I was overwhelmed, terrified even. But I shook my head because I did want to marry him. I always had. Ephraim crushed me against his chest, my arms pinned between us, before I could register his immense relief.
He buried a hand in my hair, rubbing little circles against my scalp with his thumb.
Then you must marry me, tonight. Take my name, and they can never question the legitimacy of any child you ever have.
I was neither small nor delicate. I had much of my father's height, and most of his stubbornness. And when I stood before Ephraim Ballard, I could almost look him in the eye. So I straightened my spine and leaned my forehead against the bridge of his nose. "Take me home, then," I said, "so we can be married."
2. To Housekeeping. December 1789.
I'll note you in my book of memory. Look to it well, and say you are well warned.
William Shakespeare. Henry VI.
Ballard's Mill. Tuesday, December 1. One of the great cedar doors to the mill stands ajar, and a large bay mare is tied to the post outside. I don't hear the expected sounds of saw and hatchet within, but rather the muted strain of conversation. So I stop outside the door and tip my head to one side, listening. The horse whickers, and I set a hand on its nose, urging silence so I can hear what is being said.
"I've already completed that survey," my husband argues, "and I have 3 lumber orders to fill by next Friday. I don't have time to do it again."
I have been married long enough to catch the nuance in Ephraim's voice, every clipped syllable and strained vowel, and there is no doubt he is struggling to control his temper.
"The Kennebec proprietors want it done again."
Ah, Joseph North. I press my lips together and give the horse an accusing stare. Traitor. Then pull my hand away from the soft, warm nose and slide closer to the door. Ephraim clears his throat.
"Doing it again won't change the results. They might beg to differ. They can beg all they like, but they've not seen the land. It's nothing but bog for miles in every direction, unsuitable for farming. And besides, right now, it's little more than a block of ice. They want to assign a lease on the property and doom their tenants to a life of failure and poverty?"
A drawer rattles and papers shuffle. I can hear the warning note in my husband's voice grow sharper.
"Here, the survey. I was there 2 months ago. I assume you filed the last copy I gave you."
"Not yet."
I hear the crinkle of paper as North straightens the map and then folds it again.
"I can't." "Can't or won't? It's not what they're expecting. And you know they have expectations, Ephraim.
I am not leaving my family in the dead of winter to confirm something I already know."
Ephraim's voice is now low and smooth and deceptively calm.
"Besides, I know what you're doing, Joseph. I am reminding you of your obligation."
North lightens the tone of his voice, cajoles.
"You like this lease, don't you? You like living here?"
Ephraim doesn't answer, and there is wariness in that stretch of silence.
"This land is leased to you by our mutual employers. The Kennebec proprietors can be quite generous when they're pleased with a tenant. I think you've experienced that yourself over the last 11 years. You have the lease and the surveying contract, but not the deed to this mill. Not yet."
The Kennebec proprietors, a part of the Plymouth Company in Boston, acquired vast land holdings along the Kennebec Valley 150 years ago. They own most of the land along the river for 15 miles on either side, and have been leasing it out to encourage settlement in the District of Maine. Our family assumed the lease on Ballard's Mill 11 years ago, but do not yet own the deed. That won't happen until next April, when we finally meet the third condition. The first two were met within a year of living here, building a home and tilling a minimum of 5 acres. The last, however, is a matter of time. We must live on this property for 12 consecutive years before it can become legally ours. So we are in breach of nothing. Yet I can feel the threat hanging in the air between North and my husband.
I remember the terms of our lease well enough. You don't have to remind me. Don't I? Because you seem strangely unwilling to see reason. Is one survey worth losing both your home and your income? You want me to falsify my findings? To claim it's habitable land? I want you to understand there are bigger things at stake. Without the mill and your contract, you'd find your family in a dire situation.
North pauses for a moment, and I would give anything to see his expression.
It is, as you mentioned, the dead of winter.
He has delivered his orders, but won't stand around to watch Ephraim mull over the decision. Boots shift impatiently on the worn plank floor. And since I don't want to be caught eavesdropping, I step around the door and into the mill. I say the first thing that comes to mind. Have you seen my ink? I smile at my husband, then make a show of being startled by North's presence. At his feet lies a mongrel, half mutt, some indeterminate breed that's been bastardized a dozen times over, and half coyote. He is brown and black and white with tall peaked ears, a long snout, and yellow eyes. He sees me and growls. There is a rustling in the loft, and I tilt my chin to see Percy perched on the rail, rousing his feathers. His talons pulse like a man flexing his fingers in anticipation. The bird likes neither the dog nor the growl, and from the way those hackles rise in response along the bony ridge of the cur's spine, I can see the feeling is mutual.
Hush, Cicero,
North orders, looking first at the falcon, then at the dog. After a moment, his gaze returns to me, and he says,
sit.
Cicero obeys because he must, but keeps his teeth bared. I remain standing with my arms crossed because I will not be told what to do by the likes of Joseph North. Your dog has poor manners, I tell him.
Or good judgment.
He tips his hat, but his voice is cold, and his eyes are slanted, hateful.
Martha.
Ephraim notes the exchange with a narrowed gaze. Joseph North is a genteel man, not typically given to rudeness, and I doubt my husband will tolerate another snide comment. I do not return the greeting. North wants an apology for disrupting his court last week, but he won't get one.
There, Ephraim says, nodding toward the drafting table where a small wooden box is spread open. Your ink.
My quill lays flat beside the box, the tip blackened by Ephraim's morning scribbles. Beside the writing paraphernalia is a neatly stacked pile of woodworking tools. Knives and blades of various lengths. One of them, Ephraim's favorite, is a wicked, hook-shaped thing used for stripping small branches off felled trees. A bottle of linseed oil and a polishing rag sit beside it, abandoned. The mill smells of frost and sawdust, oiled metal, and old leather. It smells like Ephraim. Where two discs of ink are usually nestled, only one remains. Ephraim crosses the floor and slides a protective arm around my waist, and I relax as his thumb strokes my ribcage.
This is your ink? North asks, lifting a hand.
It is only then that I notice the hardened disc pinched between his thumb and forefinger, the pads of which are now stained black.
Ephraim never told me that you draw.
I open my mouth to answer, but Ephraim grabs the back of my dress in his fist and pulls me closer in warning. So I shrug one shoulder instead.
I suppose it comes in handy. You must need pictures of your herbs. Speaking of which, North adds, I believe my wife will stop by for another tonic soon. Her headaches have gotten worse of late.
I have never drawn a picture in my life, and I certainly don't need one to help me remember that Lydia North requires a concoction of dried feverfew, peppermint, and ginger, combined with crushed rosemary and yarrow. It only works when I soak the herbs in brandy for 60 days, however. The result is an effective tincture that I try to keep on hand. But if Lydia's debilitating headaches have gotten worse, I blame North and all he's put her through in recent months. Regardless, his cavalier assumption that I will play nursemaid to his wife has me gnawing on the edge of my tongue. After a prolonged silence, North turns to my husband.
I'll be expecting your survey at the end of the month.
And with that, he strides out the door and swings onto his horse. The dog trots after him obediently. Ephraim lets go of my dress and picks up the hooked blade from his work table. He taps the flat against his palm as the sound of hooves retreats into the distance. More so than anything else on the workbench, that instrument looks like a thing built to maim. The rogue has lived too long, he mutters under his breath, and brings the blade down onto the drafting table in a neat arc. It lodges there, quivering, and swath of pale wood gleams beneath the cleaved board like an open wound. I peer at him, skeptical. You've been reading Shakespeare again. He shrugs, then yanks the blade free.
I like the way he delivers an insult.
Then surely you can do better than that for a man such as North. I love my husband's smile. It transforms his stoic face, revealing two rows of straight teeth and laugh lines around his eyes.
That clay-brained guts, that naughty pated fool, that whoreson, obscene, greasy tallowcatch.
Well, I say, your clay-brained, greasy whoreson took my ink. How do you plan on getting it back? He tosses the knife onto the table.
I'll buy you more.
That thing looks like revenge to me, I tell him.
What?
Your knife.
That's not a bad name for a blade.
He picks it up again, balances its weight in his palm, then brings it down onto the table once more.
Revenge it is.
After a moment, Ephraim turns back to the wide double doors that North passed through and frowns. Are you going to do it? I ask. The survey? I overheard your conversation. He scratches behind one ear.
I don't think I have much choice.
You realize he's punishing us for what I did in court?
Yes, but I think there's more to it than that.
How so?
North wants me to be hundreds of miles away when it comes time for you to testify.
Why?
Because the law of coverture prevents a woman from testifying in court without her husband present.
No, I shake my head. I give testimony in court many times a year without you being present.
Only because your profession allows you to do so regarding a woman's declaration of paternity during childbirth. Those parameters do not extend to a situation like this.
But if I'm not able to testify next month,
Rebecca Foster will lose her only witness, and her allegations will be dismissed, he says.
Mill Creek Bridge, Friday, December 4.
Goodbye, love.
Ephraim tucks his face into the crook between my neck and shoulder and presses a kiss into my skin. I can feel the warmth of his breath slide beneath the collar of my dress, even as the snow falls around us. I walked with him down the lane, all the way to the bridge over Mill Creek, to say goodbye. This has been our habit through all the long years that we have lived in Hollowell. I do not let him leave without a proper send-off. Water Street spans Mill Creek by this somewhat precarious bridge. It is made of planks nailed to rough-hewn logs that rest on a series of stone foundations. Horses can cross two abreast, but wagons must go single file. There are no rails, and the drop is 15 feet to the creek below. Only 12 foot wide and 30 foot long, it often feels as though it's held together by little more than stubbornness and wishful thinking.
But the bridge has ferried countless travelers across the creek for many years now, weathering flood and storm alike, and it needs little in the way of maintenance apart from having an occasional plank or log replaced. Ephraim checks the foundations every spring, after the thaw, and reinforces them where needed. "You will be careful, won't you?" I ask.
"Of course."
"And you will come home to me?"
"Don't I always?"
"Ah, but this would be the time you didn't, when I need you most." We stand beside Sterling, Ephraim's horse, at the near end of the bridge. My husband pulls away from me and tips my chin up with the edge of one finger so that our eyes meet.
"What is it you're worried about?"
"That you won't make it home in time, that I won't be able to testify and Rebecca will be left defenseless, that North will get away with everything."
"That won't happen. I will make it back."
"But
I will."
He looks at the falcon, who rests on the saddle swell, waiting to depart.
"I've taken precautions. We will be married 35 years this month. Don't start doubting me now."
"Doubt and fear are not the same thing," I say, following Ephraim's gaze to Percy. The bird is hooded now, so I cannot see his penetrating burnt orange eyes. And his jesses, the long, thick leather straps round his talons, are tied to the broad ridge of leather at the front of Ephraim's saddle. He can neither see nor fly. Sometimes I feel that Percy can understand us. And perhaps he can, in his own way, because his head swivels this way and that, as though listening first to Ephraim, then to me. Percy dislikes the hood, but it is the only way to ride long distances. And only on Sterling. Brutus would never allow those lethal talons to get so close. The saddle is cross-cut with sharp, savage gashes where Percy has dug into the leather. Better it than Sterling, however. To date, the bird has never injured horse or rider, and they have all learned to tolerate the arrangement. "Where will you stay?" I ask.
"Fort Halifax, but only at night. I can't camp in this weather. Riding back and forth to the site every day will eat up half my time. Otherwise, I could be home in a week."
A leather satchel, haversack, and a pack basket are strapped behind the cantle. They hold all of Ephraim's surveying tools and his winter gear and are packed tighter than usual given the weather and the distance he must travel. It will be a long 2 weeks for all of us. I look to the bank of clouds moving in from the east. "A storm is coming."
"Yes," he says. "My fingers ache."
"It's a bad time to travel."
"I've done this before. It's only snow."
"And freezing winds."
"Only for a day or two, and then it will just be winter, same as always. I'm not worried, and you shouldn't be either."
"I hate North for making you do this."
"I hate him for so many reasons this barely ranks," he says, trying to lighten my mood.
Neither of us discuss the legitimate reasons that I have to fear. But the litany runs through my mind nonetheless. All the things that could happen to him in weather like this.
2 weeks, that's all. And then I will be home, and we will make sure North is brought to justice, he says.
I step into my husband's arms, soaking up his warmth and scent. We are in the twilight years of a long love affair, and it has recently occurred to me that a day will come when one of us buries the other. But I remind myself that is the happy ending to a story like ours. It is a vow made and kept, till death do us part. It is the only acceptable outcome to a long and happy marriage, and I am determined not to fear that day whenever it arrives. I am equally determined to soak up all the days between. 2 weeks, I tell him, no more. He kisses my brow, the tip of my nose, my mouth slow and gentle, making his promise with both lips and tongue.
Goodbye, love.
The animals can sense that it is time to leave. Sterling stamps his right foreleg, and Percy rouses on his perch, shaking his feathers in anticipation. They enjoy this, I think.
and then Ephraim pulls away and swings into the saddle. He offers me one last smile. I stand in the snow and watch until he has crossed the bridge. I watch until he rounds the bend and is out of sight. "Stop feeling sorry for yourself," I mutter, then take a deep breath and turn back toward the house. But I do not move. I do not breathe. Because there, not 20 feet away, is the silver fox. She is a beautiful specimen, a coalish kind of black, except for ears, paws, breast, and tail, all of which are white. She is perched on the crest of a snowbank, an ink stain on ivory. But it is her vivid amber eyes that hold me in thrall. They seem to penetrate me, to study me. "You again," I say, then speak her name, my words a soft exhale, a mist in the frozen air. "Tempest." To name a thing is a proprietary act. It is a commitment of ownership or care or loyalty. It means something. With that single word, I have declared that this little beast is mine and that I have a responsibility to protect her. The sound of my voice does not frighten the animal. Instead, she takes a step forward, then two. I watch, still as carved marble, while the lithe creature approaches, each step elegant and deliberate. When she is a mere 8 feet away, I kneel to the snow and slowly extend my bare hand, palm up, in welcome. Only then does the fox startle and bolt into the woods. Sewell Chandlery, Friday, December 11. A man barges into the birthing room. He throws the door back, then flings off his coat in a single, smooth movement. I see this only out of the corner of my eye, however, because my patient, young Grace Sewell, is wailing and thrashing on the bed. This is her first labor, and she fights against every pang, then sobs through every respite. We have been at it all night and are both exhausted. "Out, all of you," the man orders, and because I recognize his voice, I ignore him. I have not taken instructions in a birthing room since being apprenticed to an old rusted battle axe of a midwife in Oxford. Her name was Elspeth Horn, and everything I know about midwifery I learned from her. 30 years have passed since then, and it will take more than the likes of one presumptuous man to make me shrink back from a patient. "Did you hear me?" he asks. "Yes," I say, not turning. For the first time in 3 hours, Grace is silent. She is only startled, and it won't last long, but for the moment her mouth is shut. Miracles never cease. "Then why are you still here?" he demands. "I do not leave my patients, and I do not answer to you. This woman is no longer your patient. She is mine. I have been called in to replace you." I stand then, taking in every inch of Dr. Benjamin Page's pompous 6 feet. "And this patient of yours, do you even know her name?" I ask. "Mrs. David Sewell. Her Christian name, doctor, the one that actually belongs to her. Do you know it?" He sniffs. "Her name is irrelevant. Like it was irrelevant with Joshua Burgess." I point to Grace. "You might not think a name matters in a room like this, but I assure you it is vital." I arrived at the Sewells the night before, having crossed the frozen river on foot, just before dusk. I was accompanied by the shop boy who works for David Sewell and had expected him to lead me to a private home across the street, but instead he took me right into the chandlery, where David was pacing back and forth behind the counter, looking very much like his older cousin, Henry, the town clerk. "Where is Grace?" I asked, looking around the dim store at the piles of coiled rope and barrels of oil, the shelves filled with nails and bolts and boxes of soap. He pointed to the ceiling. "It is called an appartement," he'd said,
exaggerating the French pronunciation, as he led me up the stairs at the back of the shop.
In England, they call them flats, but I prefer the European term. They're everywhere in Boston, a very convenient way to live and work.
He opened the door then and led me into the second-floor home that sat above his place of business. It consists of two small bedrooms and one larger room, combining the kitchen, dining, and living area. His young wife was there, rocking slowly in a chair, lips pursed and brow knotted. Her sour-faced mother sat beside her and held her hand.
"It hurts," Grace had told me. "I didn't think it would hurt."
"What did you think then?" I asked, kneeling beside her.
"I don't know that I thought much about it all. This part was never explained to me."
I glanced at the girl's mother, the very proper-looking Mrs. Hendricks. There was no need to alarm my daughter before she was ready.
"I tend to think of it as preparing them, not alarming them," I told her.
"I have prepared her to be a lady," Mrs. Hendricks sniffed. "Not that you can tell by this backwater village that her husband has chosen."
In reality, Grace had only been in the early stages of labor. So early, in fact, that had she been properly educated by her mother about the realities of childbirth, no one would have bothered to call for me until dawn. But I had sat up with the girl regardless, timing her contractions all night. They came every 30 to 45 minutes and lasted 20 seconds, hardly birth pangs at all. And all the while I listened to Mrs. Hendricks complain about the long, hard journey from Boston, her difficulties on the bad rural roads, and her opinions of them as well. The girl was inexperienced and scared, and when I performed an internal examination, barely dilated. Yet as the night hours dragged on, both Grace and her mother became more intimidated by the process, impatient with the results and doubtful of my ability. At some point, when I slipped out to use the privy, Mrs. Hendricks must have convinced David to send the shop boy for Dr. Page. And now he is here, trying to order me from the room.
"Let me see her," Page demands, attempting to edge me away from the bed.
"You will not manhandle me," I swat at his arm. "Cross to the other side of the bed if you wish to examine her, but I will not leave my position."
"Very well. I shall have to educate you then."
He turns to Grace.
"It is unfortunate how many country women confuse false labor for the real thing."
"I beg your pardon," I interrupt.
"Because it is obvious. Her pains are now regular and promising, that this is a false labor," he says.
"Oh, for the love of God, Grace, do not listen to this man. I have been with you all night. Your labor is early but real."
The girl is of the stiff and straight variety, well-bred and nicely mannered. If not pregnant, she would be slender and shapeless. Excellent posture, tiny waist, nose straight enough to be a ruler. Hair like a pane of glass. Grace Sewell has been bred to look nice in a gown and do as she is told. The problem is that she has always taken her orders from those with a pedigree and a formal education. So it makes sense that when she looks to Dr. Page and his fine coat, she finds comfort and familiarity. Whereas all she has gotten from me during these long hours of the night is an assurance that she must be patient, that the baby will come when it is ready, and that there is nothing to be done in the meantime but wait and walk and sleep if she can. Mrs. Hendricks rises from her chair and joins him at the side of the bed.
"What is your opinion, doctor?"
"I believe," he says, setting his medical bag on the bed beside Grace and unzipping it, "that your daughter is suffering in the way that all women of higher birth suffer."
She waits for him to continue, her eyes round and her mouth curved into a moo of attentiveness, hanging on every word.
"It has been known for centuries that wealthy and beautiful women, those who lead delicate lives and are of an upper strata, such as your daughter, suffer a great deal more during childbirth than," he looks at me,
common women. That is absurd, I tell him. If you knew anything about women, much less birth, you would know the female body works the same regardless of class.
And how many well-bred women have you delivered, Mistress Ballard? How many ladies or governors' daughters? How many wealthy women have you sat beside?
Dr. Page does not wait for me to finish drawing the breath that will school him on how many hundreds of women I have delivered, from all walks of life, before he plunges ahead.
As I thought. Now get out of the way and let me assist this woman so that I may relieve her of these false pains.
Thank you, doctor, Mrs. Hendricks says, voice breathy and submissive. What can you do for her?
Administer laudanum. She will sleep and her pains will cease.
Grace, I make my appeal directly to the girl now. Medical textbooks do suggest laudanum for a false labor. Your labor is still early but quite real, and this medicine will do you great harm.
Dr. Page clenches his jaw. I am confident in my diagnosis.
A diagnosis determined by what? I demand. You have not once checked her, internally or externally.
By observation and medical skill. Remember which of us, he turns to Grace as he finishes, has the medical degree in this room.
Grace looks at her mother, confused and terrified. What should I do?
Listen to the doctor, darling. He went to school for this.
It is decided then, and I watch in horror as Dr. Page pulls out a bottle filled with reddish-brown liquid.
50 drops ought to do it, he says.
That will knock her unconscious.
How else do you expect her to sleep? You've kept her up the entire night, chattering and performing needless examinations.
Dr. Page pulls out a dropper from a small velvet bag and begins to measure the drops into a tiny goblet.
Here,
he says, after a few moments, handing the cup to Grace.
Drink.
Please do not take that medicine, I all but yell. But Grace Sewell tips the cup backward and drains the contents into her mouth, shivers at the bitter taste, swallows with a delicate gulp, wipes her mouth with the back of her hand. Within moments, her eyes are heavy and she is breathing slowly. Dr. Page puts his things away and buckles his bag.
Have her husband call for me when the real pains begin, though I do not expect that to be for some days yet.
I watch him go, but say nothing, as I do not want to discourage his departure. The sooner that fool leaves, the sooner I can care for Grace. Mrs. Hendricks glares at me. Aren't you leaving as well?
Absolutely not.
Your daughter, I say, pointing to where the girl lies, sprawled on her back, will soon be deep in the throes of labor. But she has been rendered unconscious by that idiot. It will be a miracle if he hasn't killed her and the child both.
You don't really think that?
Of course I damn well do, I shout, and am gratified by the look of horror on Mrs. Hendricks' face as she shrinks backward. Why do you think I argued with him? I will stay exactly where I am until I know that your daughter and grandchild are well, but if they aren't, you will have Dr. Page to thank for that. Remember that the next time you panic and call a man to do a woman's job. Grace sleeps for 9 hours. I sit beside her the entire time, fretting, my fingers on the girl's wrist, counting each heartbeat. They are too slow, the contractions too weak, not nearly what is required to press a child into the world. But they do not stop, and that is its own kind of miracle. Finally, Grace begins to sweat. Each contraction hardens her belly, and she moans deep in her throat. It is the kind of sound a soldier makes when he lies near the cusp of death on a battlefield, of a wounded animal in the forest. It is the sound of a woman arriving at transition, that painful shift between labor and birth. At first, it is a panting, then a whistling, followed by a groan from deep inside her chest,
If she were awake, I could prepare her for what comes next. When Grace starts to gag, I have only seconds to sit her upright and lean her over before she vomits a foul brown plume onto the bed. Grace is covered. Her clothes are covered. The bedding is covered. But she is finally awake and instantly aware that her body is deep in the work of birthing her child. The voice comes from behind me. Mrs. Ballard, When I look to Mrs. Hendricks, I can see her throat working hard to swallow the apology. She looks away. Can Grace manage the rest of her labor? Stupid, prideful woman, I think. Yes, but thanks to you, she is no better equipped to handle the next birth. She will only remember the worst of this one, I say, then order her away to gather warm water and clean linens.
What happened?
Grace asks, as the last of the laudanum fades from her system. I believe that you have learned exactly what kind of doctor Benjamin Page truly is. Now, I look her directly in the eye as I begin to help her out of the soiled gown. Will you allow me to assist you with the thing that I do best? She nods, swallows, begins to cry.
Yes.
Good. Your mother is bringing us a wash basin. And then we are going to meet your baby. When Dr. Page comes running up the chandlery steps 2 hours later, I meet him at the door to Grace's bedroom. The girl is sitting up in bed, holding her new son with a sense of wonder and pride. When Page tries to push past me, I set a hand on his chest. You are not needed here. That is my... No, she's my patient. You would do well to learn your place, Mistress Ballard. I laugh at him. I have been in my place for many, many hours now. You, on the other hand, knocked a woman unconscious and abandoned her to the ill effects of a dangerous drug. As a result, you were not present when she began to vomit in her sleep. Had I not been in my place, she would have died. But I am curious about one thing, however. I say. He looks in alarm to the bed. What? Did you even bother to learn her name while you were gone? Any humility that might have been rising to the surface after learning his error is wiped away by a sudden flash of pride. There was no need. Then you have learned nothing. Her name is Grace, and if you were an educated man, as you claim, you would know that the name means unmerited favor, which is exactly what God has shown by allowing both her and the child to survive your ministrations. I close the door in his face. Pollard's Tavern, Saturday, December 12. There is blood in the snow. A crowd has gathered outside the tavern, and two men scuffle at its heart, arms and legs flailing. Amos and Moses Pollard stand on either side of the shrinking circle, arms out to block anyone from interfering. Abigail has wisely situated herself on the front steps, mug of steaming cider in hand, a safe distance from the fray. She looks on with disdain. I have just come from delivering Grace Sewell, and am ready to be home, but my curiosity wins out, and I cross the street to see what all the fuss is about. Men are a right bunch of fools, Abigail mutters when I reach her side. Yes, but which ones specifically? The one that's bleeding is James Wall. Before I can ask a question or jump to any conclusions, she adds, and the other is an officer of the court from Vassalboro. Came here to bring James in on charges, he did. Charges for what? She shrugs. Dunno, but James doesn't want to be brought. So they're deciding it amongst themselves. Like I said, fools. James shouldn't have resist, and the officer shouldn't have let him. Let? You'll see. And I do soon enough, when the officer grows tired of the debacle. He's an average-sized man, under 6 foot, and not so much thin as sinewy. It is clear he's been trained to box, however, and is quick on his feet. A left hook makes contact with James's jaw, sending him sprawling to the frozen mud. The officer is on him in a moment, tying his hands behind his back with a length of rope.
"As I said," the officer pants, "you are to report to Fort Western immediately to face charges for failure to pay your debts."
James spits a glob of blood onto the ground.
"I already told you. We got stuck in the river and couldn't make our delivery, so I didn't get paid. And therefore I couldn't make my payment last month."
The young officer does appear sympathetic at this, but he straightens his back and stands over James.
"The why of it is none of my business. That's for the court to decide."
The crowd watches as he pulls James to his feet and leads him to a wagon parked beside the tavern. They step aside as James is hoisted onto the seat and has his bindings tied to an iron loop attached to the wagon's sideboard. It's a sailor's knot, meant for rigging, and there's no chance it will come loose on the journey. Once satisfied that James is secure, the officer unties the reins and climbs to his seat. He tips his hat to the crowd, then flicks the leather straps and shouts,
"Ha!"
The horse turns onto Water Street and toward the north as the residents of the Hook stare silently after them.
"He lodged here last night," Abigail says, preempting my question again. "Said his name was Barnabas Lambert, but we didn't know he was an officer of the court or why he'd come. He looks to be quite young."
"Aye, about 20, I'd say. And that probably worked in his favor."
"How's that?"
"Moses told me he was asking around about James, where he lives and what he looks like. Everyone thought they must be old acquaintances. But it was the horse he was most interested in."
Abigail takes a sip of her cider and turns to me.
"Why? A man's a man, but every horse is unique. That's what he told Moses, at any rate. And 'tis well known that James rides a Narragansett pacer. He boasts of it often enough. Says it comes from Washington's own herd."
"Lies, probably.
I couldn't pick one out of a herd, mind you, but that officer could. Charged right out of the tavern the moment he saw James tie up at the post."
I look to where the horse stands beside the hitching post, confused and jittery thanks to all the excitement. It's of middling height with narrow hindquarters, and like so many other horses, is a warm chestnut brown. Black mane, black tail, black socks. The head and tail are held high, though, and I think that maybe a good horseman would know a pacer from a hackney.
"What will you do with it?" I ask, nodding to the horse.
"Board him, I guess. James can settle the bill later."
The wagon is gone now, but I look in the direction it left. I thought debtor's prison was a thing of the past. How much does James owe?
Abigail shrugs. "There wasn't much opportunity for asking questions once the punches started flying, was there? But I have heard James intends to start a distillery."
She turns those moss-green Scottish eyes on me, gives me a look filled with import.
"And that he went to Judge North for the loan."
"Why him?"
"A wealthy man is North, likes to have a finger in every pot, or so I'm told."
I turn my head to the side, take in the hulking form of the tavern behind us. "Has Amos?"
"He would never."
The crowd starts to disperse, and I see John Cowan, the young blacksmith's apprentice, saunter over to say a few words to the Pollards' oldest daughter, Catherine. We observe the pair in silence. Bowed heads, low voices. At one point, John leans closer and lightly touches Catherine's elbow when she says something. They both laugh, blush. Then he says goodbye and walks away.
"And what do you make of that?"
Abigail asks. Once again, she sips her cider, then passes the mug to me. It's good and rich, tart and strong. I swirl it around my mouth, carefully choosing my words. John is kind and hard-working. Charles Clark depends on him greatly. He's strong, responsible.
But?
I didn't say but.
Not out loud, you dinna.
I flash Abigail a quick smile. He's a good man, I believe that. But not the brightest I've ever known.
Your standards might be too high, Mistress Ballard. Not every man can be Ephraim.
She looks at me with a smile of her own.
Or Amos?
Sadly, no.
You ken my meaning. If he was to come knocking on your door, would you let him court Hannah?
Abigail and I have never discussed Moses's interest in my daughter, but it can't have escaped her notice. It isn't John Cowan who plans to come knocking. Or at least if he did, your own Moses would knock him down. We assess John's retreating form. It wouldn't be a fair fight, but neither of us say it aloud. We both like